Without further ado, let's...
Okay, thanks. I should say, it's my enormous experience. You know, I've never been surrounded by so much talented, you know, who, you know, I really feel kind of uncomfortable. One thing I learned about physicists listening to for a few days is that there are there's one called forces, you know, another is this kinetics guy, another is thermodynamics guy. They have these different angles of looking. And so the other thing was that I should say I feel uncomfortable because I'll give you a story why. I'll use Stanford people as a decoy. So these three Stanford faculty, the head of the neurosurgery department of medical school, and this physics professor, and this molecular biology professor traveling in a plane first class, going somewhere, and there's a hijacked. The plane was hijacked. Some of you might know this story. And this hijacker said that he's got this neurobiologist first, okay, said, what you have done for poor people, others, you have 15 minutes to explain, half an hour, all others are going to kill you. So this guy starts saying, you know, oh, I'm a doctor, I save people's lives, I do delicate surgery and blah, blah, blah. And the hijacker said, after 15, no, you charge too much money. So he shot and killed him. The second person, he said, you, the molecular biologist, he said, what do you have to say for to save your life, for what you've done for poor people? And he's about to say something, and the physics professor said, kill me first, kill me first. He said, why? He said, before, I don't want to hear another molecular biology talk. I'd rather die. He said. So with that, yeah, thank you. I have a lot of things I'll quickly go through. It's not relevant in this audience, but I'll try. Oh, I'm sorry. Here, the idea that you had this elegant talk for 2 days from Jonathan that is about nucleosome packaging, and I'm trying to think whether we can mimic him. We're way, way behind. There's a hope we'll reach that someday in the distant future. The idea that this is all bacteria, by the way. I work on bacteria, E. coli. Chromosomes, that's chromosome, E. coli has a chromosomal defined structure, and does it affect transcription profile? And the reason I'm giving this talk, of course, I believe that something like that is happening. Just so the protein I'm going to talk about, oh, I see, this didn't show up. Oh, it's alpha beta. So the nucleotide protein HU, which you have heard, I'm going to talk about. And most bacteria have, majority of them has homodimer. HU is a homodimer of 9 kDa each, 9.5. But in E. coli and some enteric bacteria and helicobacter, they are alpha beta heterodimers. We call them alpha and beta. They have about 66% homology, identity rather. That's the talk, okay. The reason this is nothing to looping, but the reason we got involved in the role of HU in DNA condensation and structure, organization, potential, these are hypotheses or fantasies. We got involved simply because of this. You remember that I mentioned there's a GAL loop, and to keep the GAL gene expression depressed, you need a loop, and HU is a protein which participates in stabilizing the loop, whatever way, that's a different issue. And at that time I mentioned there's a protein-protein interaction between GALR and HU, specific interaction, doesn't happen in many other repressors. And we were trying to isolate mutants, like if you had isolate GALR mutants, you get constitutive expression of the operon, that's the phenotype. Similarly, we thought HU is a participant in this. From a genetic viewpoint, you'd be able to isolate HU mutants which do not show this interaction and therefore be constitutive. And we did that, we isolated HU mutants, and many of them are deletions and null mutations. They are de-repressed for the GAL operon, but some of them are defined, as I explained, the protein-protein interaction at a specific region of HU. During that search, one mutant that survived was something which was totally super repressed, that the operon cannot be induced even by adding the sugar inducer at high concentration. We thought at the time this is a super interactor, and we set it aside and moved on and so on. We came back to that we found not only is GAL minus, that is, didn't express the GALB, which was minus for many other sugars, lactose, arabinose, blah, blah, everything. Okay, that was the phenotype. And it has more bizarre phenotype we pursued courageously, you should say. I'm sorry this alphabet doesn't show up, you see. The mutation is the HV alpha gene, and the two amino acid changes. One at residue 38, another at 42. What we believe is happening is because of this amino acid change is E. Glutamate to lysine changes at this position, okay, at a critical position, which I'll give the gory details later. And we cannot make this mutation alone. It has to be accompanied by a second side mutation at position 42, which is a valine to leucine change. You can make the valine to leucine change, there's no phenotype that we can tell, but it needs that one to be stabilized. But there's a negative extent we cannot make, doesn't mean maybe we don't know how to make it. This is a genetic jargon I have to clarify, that this mutation is dominant. If you have cell has both the mutant protein as well as wild type protein, either alpha, beta, or both, doesn't matter, this phenotype is, I'm going to show all the phenotype later, this is that phenotype shows up. However, even if the mutant wild type proteins are there, however, if you have the one gene copy of mutant protein, then provide the wild type in excess by control regulation, then the wild type phenotype comes back. And I'll show the data, okay? Okay, this is funny thing that this is E. coli, rod shaped cells, normal cells. And this is the mutant, HU3842, I'll call it. They're round, they stain gram positive. It's not a contaminant, that's what my colleague said.
Okay. It's viable.
Huh?
It's viable.
It's viable.
Do they have flagellates and everything?
I don't know. We have not done that because there's a lot of morphology you can pursue, and I'll give you a little more detail, but my main focus would be on chromosome structure. Yes, it doesn't have a lot of things. It doesn't have the E. coli, the single flagellum, yes. It's non-motile, that is the assay. Okay, it's stain gram positive, it's spherical, it's cocci, okay? Okay. Not to bore you a lot, but this is the growth, overnight growth, cell density of wild type E. coli shown by this black bars, okay, at different temperatures. So as expected, the wild type grows best at 37 degrees. It gives a lot of cells, overnight growth, saturation, different temperatures. Compared to that, the mutant grows much better, the gray bars. Okay, that's the first thing, grows very fast. Another thing is that the wild type doesn't grow over 47 degrees at all, it's well known, neither below 15 degrees. And this guy shows very well at lower temperature as well as high temperature, goes up to 47 degrees, quite a bit of growth. It has become somewhat temperature resistant. And we don't know, we don't have a molecular answer. This is the growth rate, generation time. This is the wild type, and again, a different temperature, but this guy grows, the mutant guy grows faster at particularly lower temperature. I don't have any explanation for this. This is the, I mentioned before, this is the fermentation phenotype, that is how efficiently the sugars are utilized as carbon source by this wild type is this black bars. You can see that they efficiently utilize lactose, arabinose, galactose, and all these things. And the mutant is practically defective in all of them except somewhere in glucose 1 phosphate as a carbon source. Okay.
I don't know if that is important, but how should I understand the difference between two upper plots at high temperature? The growth rate seems to be the same for mutant and wild type.
No, yeah, that's right. It is. It happens to be. This is observation. The growth rate is high, you know, say about same at high temperature. Growth rate is different, conspicuously different at lower temperatures.
But how about the left one?
No, but this is the overnight. They might grow slowly or equal rate, but they grow. Growth continues. This is when finally growth stops, you get this OD.
Oh,
okay, the growth rate and the equilibrium.
I see.
Okay, go ahead.
You showed us one of them is rods and the other one is yes. spheres of about the same diameter.
Yes, yes.
You show us an assay that's an optical density.
No, we have that. Thank you.
Mass.
Yeah, no.
How many numbers are we talking about?
Well, optical density of 2 is 2 times 10 to the power 8 and so on. 10 to the power 8 cells. We have done colony counting in hemocytometer and so on. It's not that.
Is that a measure of mass or is it a measure of number of bacteria?
We normally do crudely take the OD because you have a standard curve. And but if we are critical, we dilute and look for count the cell number of cells.
Right.
Okay.
That graph.
Yes.
The gray only a little bit bigger than the black.
No.
Numbers. Does that mean that the gray guys are many many greater numbers?
Yes. Yes. Of course.
By a factor of some huge amount.
A huge amount.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Because the cell is optical interference is less because of.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So we're talking about factors here, not just percents.
No. 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 Yeah.
Are you sure that 2460 not 02040? Because usually after 1D is after 1D.
No, I should say this particular curve. I should have, you know, I'm trying to skip this, come to a little more DNA level quickly. Is that these were done very controlled way in a fermenter where you get a large, you know, super broth. You get much higher OD than in a flask culture.
He's not kidding. You make the measurements quite diluted now.
Yeah.
So you're not trying to make a measurement of OD of 10.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Okay. Oh, I'm sorry. These are technical. Okay, sorry. You guys are so critical. Yes, sir.
Should I understand the combination of the comparable growth rate with the much higher saturation level as being connected with the lower substrate utilization so that?
No, these are done.
These all fit together in some way?
No. These, yeah, they could be, but these are done in a rich broth. So we're overcoming this any difference here and there. This guy, the mutant guy, is oxotrophic for many 8 amino acids. So they have to be supplied. Rich broth, everything is there. That's the way. Okay. And this is first property is this. Second property is that. There's a set of carbon sources. These are usually present in mammalian host, and when E. coli goes in a mammalian host, changes its phenotype, and they like to utilize this set of sugar, gluconate, particularly fructose, glucose, and so on, because they get that from our food, whatever we eat at the cafeteria, okay? And the mutant is here better compared to the wild type. And there's another group of genes, about 20% of E. coli genes are normally never expressed in laboratory culture conditions, minimal media, this media, that media, and so on. Many of these genes are expressed, which should I should have a panel here for. The mutant is totally zero, almost. But wild type is never expressed, and the mutants are expressed. Among those genes are, again, those which are normally expressed in when E. coli colonizes the mammalian host, okay? So to show this is a poor biologist physics experiment, optical thing is that this is a reversible phenotype. I said you can start with a mutant and provide the wild type protein in excess that changes the phenotype in front of your eyes. So this is a the round cell, okay? And you, with the mutant, alpha mutant, I'm sorry. And then you start expressing the wild type alpha HU in a regulated fashion. This is no IPTG, then you add IPTG, you slowly express this protein and wait. Okay, these are minutes, okay? And we have a movie, it can happen with a single cell. This is a population, and the cell divides and so on. Usually, it changes the shape, and by about 3 hours or so, it becomes a rod, okay? And we have done a single cell, okay, you follow that. And this is the mutant protein was fused to, the wild-type protein, which is being expressed to IPTG, just fused to GFP to follow, and you see the HU is expressed, and when the rod, it becomes full of green color. And this is the E. coli K12 is gram-negative, and it has a particular type of cell membrane, outer membrane, which is a stain called FM64, some chemistry, which gives a red color. The mutant doesn't stain that because they have a different kind of cell structure. And but you can regain that, you see the membrane stain.
So you think the change in phenotype is because of the change in cell wall? Mm-hmm.
Oh, that I don't know. Yeah, you're talking the cell volume. Yeah,
It. An explanation.
No, what's his name? Somebody from Oxford told me that he's E. coli, nucleoid, Addington, people think that the nucleoid structure, because of centripetal force or something, determines the cell shape.
That's the other alternative.
Yes. We have not investigated that, you know. Before we don't, I mean, I'd like to know what's happening at the DNA level to second level question, how does that structure influence it then? Okay, and this is the overlay. So, I said several genes are totally repressed in E. coli K12 and laboratory conditions. Two of them, one is the hemolysin gene. Pathogens express the hemolyse, okay, the lysines and so on. Wild type doesn't, but in this mutant, there's a blood agar plate. If blood is destroyed, then you see the halo and so on. The mutant is expressed as hemolysin.
What does this
hemolysin do? Red blood cells is lysed.
Sorry?
Red blood cells, the hemoglobin is lysed.
No, but what does E. coli do with it?
Oh, I don't know. What E. coli, when he invades your body, they try to kill you. You become sick. Hemolysin is a pathogenic, toxic gene. It's not normally expressed in wild-type E. coli, but it's expressed if you eat hamburger 0157 strains. Okay. Okay. So this is positive to start with the hamburger E. coli. I mean that 0157 E. coli.
It's basically a superbug.
Well, no, I mean, if I tell my institute, they'll kick me out. So this is all secret. Another gene, there's a, on the cell surface of wild type E. coli, I mean, there's a called Kali fiber, some Pimbri type of genes expressed in pathogenic E. coli, not expressed in wild type E. coli, and they don't stain. There's a stain for that, and the mutant expresses that, okay, Congo red dye. And this is the gene that adheres to epithelial cell when pathogens invade, and this has that property. And based on that, we follow this further. These are biology, I'm sorry to bore you with this. So we did an uptake experiment, take epithelial cells with my collaborator next door, and you add wild type E. coli shown here. So the way to do is take a given number of epithelial cells in a culture, add some given number of E. coli at a certain ratio. The ratios are shown here. This is multiplicity means one E. coli per one epithelial, 100 E. coli per one epithelial, and so on and so on. And you wait for some time, and then kill with the antibiotic, what they use, I forget, to kill the unabsorbed cells and wash them away, and look at the epithelial cell microscope, and you don't see any cell but with wild type case. Once in a while, one guy sticks here. And with the mutant cell, you see enormous amount of these round things have gone in. So it has behaving like a pathogen. So pathogenic people are studying, take a pathogen, they dissect this, all this. I thought pathogens should be studied the way can you, what is the minimal requirement, reductionist attitude to make a pathogen. This is not a pathogen. This E. coli is not a pathogen because it lacks the toxin genes like, you know, those ribosomal factor, you know, the ADP ribosylation. So if we add that, it would become toxic, but for this audience, I'm not adding. If you you know how to delete all the pathogenic HU in the pathogens in the world, yes.
No, he's worried about his experiments that he's doing next week.
Yeah. I didn't give you the mutant.
No.
Source of money for the name of security should be kept secret. Should have given this talk in that secret meeting 2 days ago. Oh, I'm sorry. I skipped. I was going to discuss that. Okay. So this is the wild type set at three different ratio. That is, ratio means one, the denominator is epithelial cells, and the numerator is, in this ratio, is the number of bacteria you add.
E. coli are in suspension and epithelial cells are on the surface.
No, we mix we take that, what you call, petri dish where you grow the epithelial cells, and we add E. coli, you just shake it a little bit, and that's it. And then we wait, and then we kill antibiotics the unabsorbed cells and wash them, and then take them and look under the microscope. This uptake of bacterial cells into, or anything, virus and so on, that's the way they do it. We just follow them. Yeah, please.
Even though this is not toxic, will it infect an organism?
The cells, we have not done any animal experiments.
If you inject this into a rat, let's
say. No, it doesn't kill. We have done that. Because it doesn't lack these phage carried toxin genes.
Yeah, will it grow or will the immune system get rid of it immediately?
No, it depends how much you add. If you have a low level, then immune system or innate immunity can take over. But if you add a high level, it doesn't.
Is it more fit than the wild type?
We have not done that because we are not equipped to do all these experiments. That's not the purpose to study pathogenicity. It might attract some money from some sources, but I'm not sure. Okay, so this is the why I'm talking here. There's the mutant phenotype because it involves HU, which is a DNA binding protein. You know, changes, all this phenotype happening is the basic change in the level of transcription. That was the idea, and the answer is yes. And we did a direct, instead of playing around this on the direct transcription, as it is in vivo, you extract RNA from wild type mutant and do a reverse, what you call RTI, you call live PCR. And so this is the wild type cells, RNA extracted wild type cells. This is the ribosomal RNA control you find with a probe, you find that RNA all the time. And Galgene is the one which is repressed. Sorry, is expressed in wild type, and you see the signal. Gali RNA is made. Hemolysin gene was an example. We have done others. Is not expressed in wild type. Phenotypically, there is no RNA. Okay. Whereas the mutant, you see the control RNA, ribosomal RNA is still there, but Gali is gone, and hemolysin is expressed. This is not quantitative, so don't worry. Okay. Okay, so it confirms, and to show these are not some deletion, you do a chromosomal PCR to show the DNA genes are there. It's just a control. Okay, so the question is, if it's transcription, we'd like to go straight to the point, okay? Is HU acting directly at the level of transcription at the promoter and so on, or some indirectly, like HU, because of such pleiotropic phenotype, it's possible HU doesn't make CRP, cyclic AMP gene, which turns up all the sugar genes. That's the indirect effect. So we do the pure in vitro lac transcription assay, which is there. There's a append up tube, RNA polymerase, some buffer, and nucleoside diphosphate, and the lac DNA template. You see, there's a control RNA one is always there, and very little lac transcription in this in vitro system. Then you had cyclic AMP CRP, you said huge amount of lac transcription. Everybody knows that, does that. There's no lac repressor, there's no lac looping here. Okay, if you add on the top of that wild type HU alpha plus, there's not much change, that was well known. But if you had the mutant HU, not only total shut off in vitro system lac transcription, but also the control RNA also disappeared. It's a inhibiting transcription in general. Okay, bottom is a pro-U gene, which is not expressed in wild-type E. coli under normal conditions, but is expressed in the mutant. Phenotypically, you know that. Okay, do in vitro transcription with nothing else present, is very little signal. With wild-type H, you get as little. It needs to be quantitated by a concentration curve. We have not done that. But the mutant H, you get enormous transcription. So its direct effect on transcription presence basis, okay? Remember this slide. The next slide has the same picture. That is, wild type doesn't, DNA alone doesn't do anything. HU, wild type doesn't do much. But the mutant HU in vitro system increases transcription. And okay, so question is HU acts by modifying the DNA structure, or HU has some role going to the promoter region, acting as a transcription factor for a specific promoter, either positively or negatively? That's the issue. That, continuing the previous slide's experiments, is the data here. This is, I shared before, that DNA, that is nothing with wild type HU is nothing, and then mutant. This is same experiment as shown before. Only difference is that, well, this experiment was done with, these are plasmid DNA carrying those promoters, okay? And that plasmid was extracted from wild type E. coli. Everybody does that. We grow the plasmid, and to prepare the template, you extract the DNA, purified, protein-free, and so on, protein-free, underlying, and you extract. And that is supercoiled plasmid, by the way, negatively supercoiled plasmid. But if we extract that plasmid DNA from the mutant cell, which behaves in this funny way, and use that as a template, pure DNA extracted from that, no protein detectable, then use that as a template, you see a surprising result. Without adding just polymerase alone is transcribing. And with wild-type HU, there is some increase, and the mutant HU, there's some additive effect.
If you warm that DNA up and cool it down, what happens?
We have not done that, I know. He's five slides ahead, okay. Okay, no, we have not done that experiment. Okay, we'll do that.
So, on the right-hand side, there's no RNA polymerase?
No, no, polymerase. Yeah, I'm saying
adding pure DNA.
Pure DNA.
But the pure DNA knows about the proteins that used to be bound to.
Okay, so but you.
So the memory left. DNA.
Something in the supercomputer.
DNA from coming out of the mutant cell has some memory that is giving this property. That's what we're interpreting.
You never
linearized. No. You just any. We're not touch anything to heat or warm it up or cool it down or.
You do extract it. So what do you do?
Do you federal extraction or this is?
No, this we tried this Kyogen, all these things, and the idea that some protein might be still bound there. That was one of the major issues. We did phenolize and so on and so on, and you know, without nicking. We sometimes you get nicked. You use only the band. Okay, the tentative conclusion at the moment, there could be other exotic explanation that some memory is left in the DNA.
Do you use
proteases also? Protein SK, everything has been treated, yeah. There's no, if there is a undetectable amount of protein present, we like to know that a tiny amount undetectable is a massive effect. That should be some magical protein. Acting catalytically, right? I mean, because it's undetectable. If it's there, we cannot argue.
The level of protein you can detect in the DNA.
Yeah, we have done this past all this, but always there is a possibility some peptide, somewhere there, tiny amount which doesn't stain, you know, and so on is possible. Doesn't have OD, it's not tyrosine. Okay. So how does HU change the DNA? And that's the basic issue. And the answer, I don't know, but we'll give you one experiment which suggests something. Okay. So the conclusion is, from the in vitro experiment, HU does something directly to DNA. So we went back to do some electron microscopy, thin section of wild-type E. coli. This is the rod. Wild-type E. coli is a rod, huge rod. Part of its section, the thin section microscopy, this is the nucleoid area. And I'm told that this is some stain artifact. It's not that there's a hole. It's not a donut. Okay, this is normally. And if you make the cross-section in, you know, which would you say, cross-section. And you see this round structure. This is the nucleoid. This is the nucleoid and so on. This is white tab. These are in textbooks. We didn't copy them, but we confirmed them. Okay. So this is the mutant. You remember they're all spheres. And this is a peculiar cell wall. The membrane E. coli negative outer membrane is gone. And we are not analyzing what this is and why the structure morphology changes. Okay, but the nucleoid area is much more condensed in volume wise. The whole E. coli is smaller, that's one thing, but also the nucleoid is enormously condensed compared to this guy. This is already condensed that we study, DNA condensation and protein moving around from strand 1D, 3D, we heard, okay? But this is much more condensed, okay? So we went to in vitro. Now, in vitro, everybody has in bacterial nucleoid, this is a typical picture that if you lyse the E. coli cells and take a picture very carefully, you see this structure, one in out of 2,000 molecules. You see, otherwise it's total mess. Many people believe E. coli nucleoid has this large loops, about 200 of them or so, anchored at central position with something. And that has not been identified. What there used to be candidates. They're not HU, they're not IHF, they're not face all these usual suspects. They're not that. But many people feel it. And these large loops, are topologically independent domain. If you destroy or change somehow one domain, the other remain supercoiled. They're all supercoiled DNA. And this is the way people think. I have a problem. We try to repeat this. When you went to this point that we look at the nucleoid structure, we followed this procedure. It's the Kornberg standard procedure of lysozyme. You lyse these cells to extract enzyme or RNA polymerase. They use the same thing. And this is enormously viscous, so you cannot pipette. intact nucleon. So we gave up. And we, our aim was to isolate nucleon from a HU deleted host. And we finally succeeded, okay, by adding the technique we borrowed from Steve Zimmerman, who isolated and studies Ecobacterial nucleon by adding in presence of lots of positive charge like lysine or spermidine and so on. Then it's non-viscous. You can take nucleon and do experiments who are doing that. Doing that, we got something and we took a picture which was not clean like this, but they're messy, like a spaghetti. So we took that DNA prep and added mutant and wild type HU in vitro incubated in an amount for each nucleon, the 50,000 copies of HU approximate estimate, we added 50,000 copies of HU in vitro, okay, and looked at the structure. And this is the phase contrast micro, there's no EM structure here. With wild type HU, that huge mass condenses to something like that. This is fluorescence, okay? But the mutant HU, the same DNA, 4 megabase DNA is this. Okay, so it condenses. It's a superficial, some arbitrary conclusion that wild type HU does condense DNA, everybody would agree, and the mutant HU condenses more. That's the, this is kind of trying to mimic the in vivo structure. Okay, this is an AFM picture. You take the same in vitro experiment. This is a plectronomic supercoiled DNA plasmid from wild-type E. coli, negatively supercoiled. You add different amounts of wild-type HU to that and look at it again. At a saturating amount of wild-type HU, you see the structure. Adding more HU doesn't make any difference. That is, this plectronomic DNA becomes this, okay? And we, go ahead.
How did you see that the plectronomic is so tight and that
No, they are more tight. I thought our microscopy is not great. People have seen real superhelical negative turn.
Yeah.
Yes. It's just, it's blame our technology.
Because it really depends on the absorption conditions.
Yeah, I agree.
Magnesium again?
With magnesium, yes. Yeah, yeah, right. So I'm not going to go into teeny many details, is that because we're not there yet to study. Whenever a typical model will do all the fancy experiments. The way you interpret that, there are about 9 or 10 or whatever, you know, plectronomic turns have been absorbed by wild-type HU to make a solenoidal turn, and here and there randomly. And we know HU binds cooperatively in our hand to supercoiled DNA, not to linear DNA. Linear DNA doesn't give cooperative binding, supercoiled DNA does. And that's the way you are interpreting that. Okay, you see more and more opening up the structure, the spreads and so on. And the supercoil here and there with HU making solenoidal structure. This is the mutant HU, C, D, E. We add 10 to 1 ratio, much less ratio, you already begin to see that kind of structure at this ratio. At this ratio, wild type doesn't do much. This is 1 to 50, you see a lot of condensation with still some sticking out, some of them. At same concentration as this, they're all spherical balls. Okay, they become condensed. We have no idea what is condensation, but we'll speculate.
So linear DNA is then probably also condensed?
Yes. We have used lambda DNA, which gives a larger sphere, spherical ball, yes. This doesn't discriminate. Okay, and I think this like might be the linear DNA. Yeah, this is linear DNA. Linear DNA, this is the DNA. This is should not be put here. With wild type HU, alpha plus beta plus is here. This is just DNA alone. I think it's a plasmid DNA cut, okay, linearized. With wild type HU, it's a cartoon. There's some bending should be there. We cannot tell much difference, but they bind here and there. You can see that. Okay, we are not even saying which will come with the discussion later, the nature of this. I'm calling them wild-type HU, this signal, okay? With the mutant HU, you give this kind of structure. So we are interpreting arbitrarily, with all due respect to Jonathan, that there's some structure like that.
Wouldn't the radius be even smaller than it is in
What should be smaller?
The bending of DNA should be huge here, no?
Compared to
here, you mean?
Or the nucleosome.
Oh, they are bent, but I'm not. making a big deal, but our fantasy that this structure represents this kind of structure. How many turns and so on, I'm not.
But you could have measured that from the length you get.
We have not done that. We could. You have to. Actually, this is in progress. I'm not showing a chronological order. This we did later because of the.
You can estimate it quickly. The difference in extension is about 20 nanometers divided by 2 pi.
Yeah. So it's more than one round. More than. No, but you don't know the structure. Okay, yeah.
It's right.
Oh, yes. Oh, no. Yeah, I'm not comparing the nucleosome.
Is I'm calculating the radius, David?
Yeah.
The radius, you don't know that yet.
3 nanometers, but the radius of the nucleosome to the DNA center is 5, protein core is 4.
Let's postpone that. We have more data to make some quantitative estimation of this. Fantasy. Okay.
L and H here.
Or the height. In AFM, you can tell the height, the depth.
Yeah. That is H.
Yeah. That's H.
Do we know if you use dimerized,
No. I'm come to that. That's why I don't want to get involved in this discussion without that knowledge. I'll give you the details.
L is a contour length that you've mentioned just on the projection.
L is this. Yeah. Right. Which decreases. You see that. This is in this range and it's somewhat different, okay? So this I'm not going to make it too much big deal, okay? But this discussion should be kept postponed. I'm going to show you the number of subunits there and so on, size, okay? Let's wait for that.
One quick question.
Yeah, please.
Just wondering, in the next one you show that you can actually see that block that looks like. You assume that that's H, but why can't you see it here?
Say that again.
In the other AFM pictures, you see that white block.
You
assume that's H.
Yeah.
Well, why can't you see it down here? Is it just the magnification?
You mean here?
It's just all condensed and it's hard to.
You mean this guy?
If you saw that, would you be able to tell where H is found?
Yeah, you can tell. But not with wild type H, you cannot see much, okay? Now, let me postpone. The size of the HU is unknown at this slide, okay?
Any man wear the background F gone in other pictures. You have to have only the HU. F, you have HU waves gone in other picture.
The background HU?
Yes.
Oh, the background HU, you know, these are, we selected field, there's no noise. You know, you can take pictures anywhere you want, or just to make a clean, decent presentation in California, you know. In Washington, it could be dirty. Okay. So that structure you get that with white.
Sorry. I don't know whether it's important, but that didn't make any sense to me. If this is a typical field.
It's not important. That's why.
It has a typical field has 1,000 dots.
No.
In it. You're gonna have to look for a long time.
No. I should not. I mean, let's go back. You are so picky. Okay. Let me give you the fact. Okay. That picture, you're talking this picture versus this picture. This is what done with a concentrated HU added to see whether you can see HU and so on. And this we believe are many aggregates. Wild type HU normally you cannot see, maybe a speckle. These are to show the range of the protein in the background. So this is not the same specimen as this one. Okay. You guys are, you know, no molecular biologist asked me that kind of question. They're so picky. You guys are picky. Okay, so this is a gel mobility assay of a supercoiled plasmid DNA mixed with HU, saturating concentration of wild type HU or mutant HU. Okay, you remember the pictures from there. So you take that, and this is the plasmid DNA here, supercoiled DNA. You have different concentration of wild type HU, and the mobility stops here. It doesn't go very far with that. We presume that's the structure. The open structure. This is the mutant HU and goes here, quickly goes here. Doesn't get out of the well. There, I should also mention is a chemical issue that is a structural issue that is this why mutant HU doesn't stain very well with helium bromide. They are there, you can extract them and show they're there for some reason.
What is the stoichiometry of the protein?
Yeah, I'll
highest concentration
is 100. 100, which one? 100. these two, these and these. One molecule of, not phosphodiester, one molecule of plasmid with 100 molecules of HU, yeah. Dimer estimation.
So why do you, could this be simply a new charge neutralization effect, that these spherical blobs, which are not too big, don't end up in general?
Most likely, but I cannot tell. Okay. Okay, so that's, so you take this DNA for white complex and this complex, I mean not extracted from gel but made in solution, and digest with EcoR1. EcoR1 has one site in this plasmid, and you can see this is the plasmid and this is the plasmid, this DNA, okay, with bound to wild type HU, and it digests with R1. You add R1, it comes back to linearized position. With mutant HU, this is here, protein alone is there, but R1 doesn't digest.
You should make a plus in the label.
Oh, I'm sorry. You are right. Yeah, there should be plus here. Okay, I'm sorry. It's there. Okay.
Hmm? No.
He said yesterday he never pays any attention to what people say. He admitted that. He sees only directly, so focused. He's a laser eye focusing, okay? This is, DNA is one digestion. This is specific digestion. Somehow the R1 site is not accessible sterically or change in structure or something R1 cannot recognize. This is the same with wild type HU. This guy is here, and you add more and more DNA is one, they get rapidly degraded. This guy, nothing happens. Okay, sense insensitive even to DNase1, which is a non-specific nuclease and is somehow protected, somehow. Yeah. You can extract. Yes, and you can. It goes back there.
And it's still, so DNase1 doesn't do anything.
DNase doesn't. No. These are, we have said, if you extract phenol, it comes back here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is with plasmid that is
DNA
from a wild type.
We're not done that. That was a more recent experiment. I'm not saying historical order. Okay, these are just, I always change slides in some random fashion. Okay, so far the conclusion is the mutant HU changes DNA somehow, that's why I put quote unquote. Okay, the change may be specific or some random things. Might be there some sites which are targeting, we don't know. And it changes the transcription profile. That's what we are after. What does it do to DNA to change its transcription pattern? Okay, so at this stage we wanted to know the structure of HU. We have done the published HU structure that everybody uses are homodimers from other organisms, Anabina and Bacillus, Stereothermophilus and so on. And their structure, this is wild type structure, alpha beta, alpha plus beta plus, heterodimer. And we are doing the structure of the mutant, so I don't know the structure of the mutant yet. So we did the structure. This is the structure of, from HU homodimer from Anabina Phoebe Rice's lab. This is one, this is a dimer, of course. And this is a, ignore the color, I don't know what it means. The structure, this is the beta loop that enters into minor group of a DNA. And this dimer, this other one, is an inverted symmetry structure. This is the structure. Our basic structure, the dimeric structure is more or less same as that. Our structure, we couldn't crystallize, neither has anybody else, DNA-free HU. It only crystallizes with DNA, and that's, there's a DNA I'm not showing here. I'll bring it back later. Our DNA, we added DNA, all kinds of DNA, including the one that Phoebe Rice used to have these kinks and flip out things. It crystallized in every cases, okay, or not in every cases, some cases. They get the same structure, but we never see DNA. We tried very hard with all kinds of expertise. By the way, I'm not a crystallographer. We are doing, in starting, I had to learn Bragg's equation first before I tried. Okay, so we cannot, I don't really know, nobody can tell me why DNA is not there. One possibility is vibrating, you don't have order density, or maybe some DNA's contamination is there, they got nicked and so on.
You see the protein?
The protein, I'm going to show you the protein.
No. So in the X-ray you see the protein but not the DNA?
That's right. We don't see the DNA in the X-ray, that's what I said.
The crystals contain DNA?
The crystal was, it crystallized only in the presence of DNA, crystal contained DNA. If you take the crystal,
geometrically and everything.
Well, we add stoichiometrically, and we also know that if you take the crystal redissolve and take your OD 260 there, but I
The DNA is there.
DNA is there, but I cannot tell you whether you did that recovery DNA in a quantitative way.
It should be almost quantitative.
This experiment says the nucleotides are still there. It doesn't say they're intact.
Right, yeah. I said it's hard to quantitate. Hate to say that, but Fu Shengguo is doing this, suspects, he has done this, spent several months to why DNA is not there. He suspects a nucleus contamination in H2 peppers. It's always a possibility. We try to purify the best you can, but he now believes there's the intrinsic property, intrinsic nucleus activity there, and he took the HU prep, our prep, and different preps, okay, acid. If we add magnesium, he finds slight nucleus activity. It happens only in presence of magnesium, not magnesium. So I don't know, it still could be, most likely it's a contamination, we just can't rule it out. Okay, this is the structure. The DNA, including the beta loop, are missing. We don't see that. But the rest of the structure, more or less same, except there's a, between two alpha helices, each color is alpha subunit and the, oh. No, this alpha meta means alpha helix and beta sheet, okay, sorry. Red is one subunit and blue is another subunit, and this is missing here for the reasons, okay. This is basic force are same, like it's shown here, the alpha helices and three helices and three beta sheet strands and so on, and some missing here and there, okay.
Missing from the structure.
Missing from the structure, yeah, right. So this is, doesn't matter, this is the your Ulu cell. Okay, the same thing. So interestingly, this is the most interesting part to us, okay? That is, you can see in the crystal lattice three different potential arrangement. Each color is one dimer, okay? And you can see the arrange in this fashion, all the dimers in the crystal structure. You can see the three possible ways you can look unit, you know, this pattern. We call feasibility or arrangement one, and this is another one I'll go to in detail, arrangement two, arrangement three. This could be crystal packing artifact. There's different possibilities, pure, okay? Like a mosaic, you can divide in different ways, okay? And each unit is an octamer. There are four dimers in each unit, one, two, three, four, octamer. It has a ringing something. Okay, the feasibility one, cross-section structure. Okay, this is the one we have not pursued, is a kind of funny structure. Here, this is one dimer, another dimer, and on the top of that stack are superimposed two other dimers. Remember that our DNA loop is missing here. Okay, we just closed it in the computer to show that. So if DNA binds here, it should bind there, one there, and this structure is inverted. The DNA loops are here and there. We have modeled that. You can put a piece of DNA. The only you can push up DNA is in between a slanted way, which can go around in some funny way and there. Okay, I'm not going to talk anymore about that structure, except my fantasy, in the light of what I'm going to tell you later, this is the one, is the boundary element, form the boundary element. Yesterday was a loaded question to you. They're octameric structure. The structure 2 and 3, potential structure 2 and 3. This is feasibility 2. This is again octamer, okay? And each dimer partly is superimposed on the top of another one. So give a spiral structure. It's an octameric unit, is a spiral structure. We assume the spiral will continue. In the crystal, it does. So it's a spiral structure. Yeah. Okay, I'll come to that. Okay. Should I have a slide to? Let me show you that. It's not in the DNA binding domain. Let me go back to that structure. Maybe I can here. The mutation is here or there. 38, that change, that critical change. Okay. It's not in the DNA binding domain. DNA affinity for the two proteins, the linear piece of fragment is same. Okay, this gives a spiral structure. The next one is a different arrangement, that but also feasibility 3 is a cross section, again gives a spiral structure, but superimposed. Okay, and it may continue. Interesting thing is the rotational thing of the spiral. This is the side view of the two. We have put two octamers here, octameric units, and here the rotation is right-handed. Okay, you can put model here. I'm not very good in that. One of you has to help me. But DNA, if you join the ends of the DNA, it would give a right-handed helix. This is a modeling. Okay, this structure too, if it exists in reality, then if you wrap around the DNA, that we don't have the DNA, we're modeling DNA, putting here and there. That's hard to do, unreal. But if you can wrap around in with the chalk, it would give a right-handed spiral.
Is that the correct direction for the plectinium, or is that backwards?
No, this is the backward, but the 3 is the right one. Okay, this is a left-handed spiral, and if your DNA fits in perfectly well, to give a negative supercluster. Go ahead, please.
Can the white flag HQ
in analytical artisanal centrifugation study, mostly is a dimer. Okay, we believe that in crystal is crystal. You know, you see this dimer, tetramer, you don't know.
Yeah, this is the white type.
No, crystal is wild type.
Crystal is wild type.
Yeah.
Yes.
These are three potential structures in solution. In solution, we don't see mostly it's dimer, the wild type. Okay? In solution, the mutant is mostly octamer. Okay? That's solution study. Okay? Wild type HU in our hand binds cooperatively to supercoiled DNA. So we believe the wild type HU octamerize or polymerize on DNA. Okay, so these are the two potential I said, that is, one has a potential to give a positive superhelical structure, the other negative superhelical structure. And if you take the DNA out, protein vanish, the protein in the computer, you see the structure 3 gives a typical negative superhelicity. Left-handed, this is right-handed. Except we have problem joining, but this is the piece of DNA came from hybridized, a kind of funny DNA. I wish we had DNA so we can make the real thing rather than modeling. That's what it is, okay? So it suggests the wild type HU has a potential of generating supercoil, negative supercoil, or positive, okay? The fact that is in the literature for 10, 12 years is true that wild type HU retains negative superhelicity. By what they mean that if you take these are interface identified which gives structure 1, and there are interfaces, you can define interfaces, structure 2 or structure 3. So you can mutate one of these amino acids to destroy and see potential change of power. We have done it with one, I'll show the result. Okay, and that is that this guy, our suspect, okay, is a guy we have mutated because he's typically involved in structure 2 and so on. Okay, we will show that. Okay, so the assay here, this is assay in the literature for HU. You take a relaxed circle, add HU, and wait for some time, and then add topo 1. Because if it creates negative supercoil, you have to relax the other side, that's your top one, and then deproteinize and run a gel, 2D gel, DNA gel. This is a number, this is substrate material without any treatment. Run a 2D gel, you get a 2 or 3 topoisomers. Okay, we cannot make a perfect one species. And with increasing amount of wild type HU, you see they become more and more negatively super, comes down here. These are chloroquine 2D gel, and this is highly supercoiled at this concentration. Come here, button. This is mutant, the 38K mutant. And here you see, we started with purpose. We have done the same thing, have a distribution of topoisomers to start with by design. And we had HU, but except in this case, the scale is much higher in the sense you have to, at very high concentration, you see positive supercoil. This guy. You see, normally negative supercoil this way and positive supercoil is, you know, somewhat tinted to the right. And you see that this is positive supercoil. Okay, so mutant HU generates positive supercoil in vitro, and it hardly can do negative supercoil. You know, it's not much change here. A little bit goes down, a little bit, then comes back here. It's positive supercoil. And this is the mutant. We took this guy and changed to an alanine, one experiment. This is the only one we have done so far. And this wild type protein, except the alanine change here, at that residue, and that of course didn't give positive supercoil, but it gives almost no negative supercoil. Whatever we start with remains the same way, more or less. The central position, the most fat band, changes a little bit, even to this high concentration compared to this guy. So we believe superhelicity, this residue is involved in superhelicity, in DNA generating negative superhelicity, and this guy, you can change to that amino acid. The idea is that HU has different potentials from the crystal structure. They are in equilibrium. Even there are reports that alpha-alpha homodimer, beta-beta homodimer, we're purifying those proteins separately to see. But the conclusion at HU, that they are equilibrium, say in wild type, you don't have the structure too much to give positive supercoil, but the mutant has changed the equilibrium toward structure 2, so it can generate positive supercoil. Okay?
So there's an equilibrium between topo isomers and HU, right?
Yeah.
And topo is.
It just relaxes.
Not negative supercoil.
Topo can take positive supercoil. This is human.
Topo?
It can.
Moves a negative supercoil or adds a negative?
No.
Relax it to zero.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So this, when top one was added, HU is there. Whatever was protected by HU, presumably by solenoidal structure, would not be touched by top one. The rest is become zero, and you remove the protein.
And
that's the acid.
This gel, this is a 2D gel.
Yeah, it's a 2D gel. Yeah. It goes this way and this way.
No.
Oh. Sorry.
That's a 1D gel.
No, it's 2D gel. This is 2D gel. Because 1D gel, you just get a ladder here.
Okay, but you didn't really need the 2D gel.
I didn't what?
You didn't really need the 2D
gel. Oh, no, I know. Yeah,
oh,
but
yeah, yeah, to see that.
To see positive, negative.
Yes,
no, right.
That, yes.
We, you know, we.
Rotate the gel? 90 degrees?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
You change conditions.
Okay.
You
I'm doing.
Ask Leonard, I'm sure he doesn't
want to
discuss
it. Is what,
sorry.
He has the right answer. Sorry. Okay, so I not go to this pull-down assay. You know, we have not done a lot of assays called chip assay. That is, to study what region of E. coli is covered by wild-type mutant HU, and I'll just summarize the result because it's an ongoing experiment. For example, we have probed the GAL, which is silenced promoter, okay, you can pull down by, when you have mutant HU, you can pull down the entire region by anti-HU antibody. So this region is covered. This don't give too much importance how many are there, just covered. You don't know how many are there in terms of dimer, trimer, tetramer. Okay, it's covered. This is the one which is silenced. And this is the one, example one, is activated. Normally, there's a protein called HNS keeps this guy repressed, okay, normal cases. And we find this very small patch, only one probe can pull down some HU, suggesting the occupation is limited, but whatever that is, we believe this is repression, and when this guy bounds there, whether these are there or not, we don't know, it activates the transcription. So the mutant HU, unlike wild type, goes to some region and covers it up, another region it not ignite, activated. Okay, so it's pure speculation. Maybe, you know, negative supercoil DNA is needed for normal gene expression, including GAL, and this is giving positive supercoiling at this region to shut off gene. Many genes are shut off. Okay, and either positive or some component, you know, bringing this cleaning this up and to activate those genes.
I was wondering earlier, and this slide makes me wonder again, whether the activation that you get is an indirect consequence of limiting numbers of polymerase in the cell being now excluded from a large set of promoters.
Okay, so yeah, that's a good argument is used for other things, but I believe that if you do that, say polymerase availability, like dividing a pie, pizza, cake, and so on, okay, so you get a larger share, you know. Okay, so you would not be specific. Then many genes, okay, that's an argument. I'm not. Yeah, please.
So you can understand the way this, you would have this large modification is that the mutated HE would actually increase the sigma that's occurring in the DNA.
Yes.
It make it more negative, except where it is bound. And this would affect opening up of promoters for RNA polymerase all over the place. And would change the level of transcription all over the place. It's not a direct effect, but it's an indirect effect.
Well, Jonathan said that. Yeah.
What he's observing are
specific. It's not freeing up everything.
Specific because various promoters open differently from respect to sequence.
Yes. Yes, it could be. It's possible. Yeah, and there is not enough HU, 50,000 molecules, which is choose wild type mutant, approximately, and that will not cover the whole chromosome like nucleosome.
And the fact that it leaves DNA modified, which is one of the surprising result, could be due to the fact that if DNA is denatured locally to the promoter, it could be attacked, modified.
No, but I said that has positive supercoil.
This positive supercoil around the HU, but which means that it will generate negative supercoil, compensatory negative supercoil.
You're talking in vivo.
I'm trying to understand why would the DNA be modified in presence of your mutant HU?
The model is that
the memory that you're mentioning.
That is positive supercoil. It created positive supercoil which remained there, okay, after phenol, okay, and that's the memory.
Topoisomerase
is an assay. In vivo, it can create negative, positive or negative supercoilicity. In a plasmid, we add that and to see these in the plasmid or the extractable wild type cell or mutant cell in vivo, it has done all those things. The net result is positive supercoiling, as you can see, extracting DNA and removing the proteins.
But the assay that you showed where you tested RNA transcription.
Yeah.
Right, and you showed that RNA transcription was much more efficient.
For one gene, not for the other.
One gene, but.
One type of gene, not for the other kind.
For the mutant HU. Right?
Yeah, right.
This you extracted DNA, and you said that you extracted DNA without any proteins.
Right.
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 And you saw a big difference between the two.
Yes.
DNA in this case was supercoiled though.
Yeah, of course, supercoil. We are saying that supercoil is positive supercoil.
So you said you isolated. This is supercoiling of the whole nucleoid. DNA.
You're talking in vivo or in vitro? The assay was not whole nucleoid, it's a plasmid DNA.
Plasmid.
Yeah.
In the plasmid, you extracted from the
tissue mutant host. Right, cells. Right.
The supercoiling level is different, and that's what causes the.
That's the hypothesis.
But did you check the supercoiling on these plasmids?
Well, yeah, okay. I'm
sorry to observe that you see no difference then.
No. In the in vivo plasmid, it was used for transcription template. Either from wild type E. coli, we have not done the 2D gel. In 1D gel, you see supercoil ladders. Okay.
This means the negative supercoiling is less than if you normally extract the supercoil.
Yeah.
It's all at the bottom. It's strong super negative.
Yeah, about 9 or 10.
And the mutants, these are sort of spread out and closer to the relax, is that?
That's the supercoiling assay, but if you extract the DNA from plasmid, okay, from the in vivo host, mutant wild type, you see the wild type plasmid coming from wild type HU or host, you give the same band, all condensed.
You're running the cells without interpolator, so it can't tell positive.
Right.
If it's really strongly positive, yes, you're right.
That's the
Slide.
Yeah, we need to run that in vivo plasmids in a 2D gel, which you are not. Yeah, okay, yeah, right, same thing. I mean, we feel more comfortable to see distinction if the slant, you know, the 2D gel. Yeah, please.
Can I just naively think that what's happening is H-U bind, the super coil. Now, DNA can, you know, if there is a nick, like it can twist.
Yeah.
And lock in right, basically over twisting.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So now if I take it out and strip it of the protein,
yeah,
it will still be twisted.
Yes.
Until it is nicked again.
Yes.
And it can relax.
Go back. Go. So, yeah.
So presumably there's somehow the difference, you know, perhaps in vitro if you add the HUs and your super coil, but somehow can be certain that you don't have single strand breaks, but then presumably that should be reversible. So you unbind HU and you lose the memory of HU being there.
Mm-hmm.
But if you allow a strand break, then you can lock in the memory.
Right. Except that to our knowledge, as much as you can tell, HU itself doesn't have any nicking closing activity.
But in the cell there are other enzymes.
Right, but that would, we are only extracting the super coil plasmid. We don't, there are always some, when you isolate plasmid, there's something left in the linearized region or relaxed region. We don't take that.
So is it fair to imagine that in the cell,
yes,
if you super coil this plasmid by
whatever, yeah,
HU,
yeah, right,
there's the super enzymes and it will relax, you know, nick,
yes,
relax,
yeah, that's
the DNA. And but if you do the same thing in some clean
test tube
situation,
yes,
there are no such enzymes and the effect of HU will be reversible.
No, yeah, absolutely, yeah, but the way we...
Can you add some licking enzyme?
That's the way it was done. We add HU, you take a clean super coil DNA, or linearized, sorry, what you call it? Relaxed circle. We add HU, let it do whatever it does. Okay, we wait for some time, and then you add nicking and closing enzyme, which takes care of all the rest, and then we remove all the proteins.
Sorry, yes.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Okay. And I think.
When you feel like.
Yeah. No. I'm feeling now. So, you know, you can survive so much physics questions. You know. So these are proposals. It's not a hypothesis even, and not a conclusion. That is, bacterial nucleoid we believe has a defined structure because of its effect, superlicity and so on, and the. I don't know what is this. HU protein models the bacterial nucleoid in some fashion, and altered HU, we have shown, remodels the nucleoid structure, that's the proposal, and deorganizes the transcription pattern in some overall fashion. We have nowhere near molecular anything, and I think these are the people. I think the HU was done by Sudesna Kaur and the crystal structure by Fuseng Guo. Okay, I think I'll break here, and by the way, I don't have much to say about this subject. I can talk a little bit of looping or something else later if you want to come back. You don't have to come back.
So in your